All right, we're at chapter 3, if you recall. Exodus, the third chapter. And we've seen Moses now. We were dealing with the burning bush, and we have seen him, of course, at the very beginning of the chapter. He is doing work with regard to his father-in-law's flock. And so he's been really having a humble existence for about 40 years now, and he's working hard and not even being overly successful, whatever that means, whatever. You know, I don't know what he was endeavoring to do. Maybe he was trying to lay low, but he's been a shepherd for a good while, it would seem. We're not told exactly how long. But he doesn't even yet have his own flock, and you know whether that may not have even been his goal. He's just working, and it's hard work being a shepherd and doing all of that. And so he's really kind of been humbled. We don't know all about Moses in those early years, those previous 40 years, as he grew up in the palace of Egypt. But we do know he had clout. He was involved, as we've learned from Acts chapter 7, that he was involved in many mighty works and deeds. So he was mighty in words and deeds. And so he accomplished some things. I think I've mentioned to you perhaps that Josephus said he even won a few battles. I wouldn't call them wars probably, but was in the military, even if you can trust what Josephus says. But all of that just shows that he was somebody. He had being Pharaoh's daughter's son, he had some power and clout. And so he's a long ways away from that now, being a simple shepherd, again, without even his own flock. And so he has been humbled, it would seem. And as we go forward, we notice in the future that he becomes or is the most humble man on earth, the meekest man on earth. And so all of that says a lot about his character, and perhaps these 40 years help shape him along those lines. But here he is, and so he's tending to the flock. He is, it says at verse 2, or the end of verse 1, it says, and he led the flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of the bush. We talked about that last week. He looked, and behold, the bush was burning, and yet it was not consumed. Moses said, I will turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. And when the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses. And he said, here I am. And then he said, do not come near and take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. And so we said a little bit about that last week, and certainly it's something worth making sure we have in our minds, the holiness of God. And this passage, along with several others in the Bible, of course, accentuates the great holiness. We always think of Isaiah 6 at verse 1, where the creatures from heaven cry out, holy, 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 with regard to God. But he's holy. He's set apart. Everything about him is set apart. His power is set apart from man's. We can't even understand and comprehend how great God is. His love, his overall character, his knowledge, everything about God is set apart. He's holy. And it's important that we always, in our day-to-day lives, that we understand who we're dealing with our Creator, that he is a holy God. And our recognition of that should be seen in every walk of our life. It should be seen, especially when we come together like this, we ought to recognize we're serving a holy God, a God that deserves honor and praise. And so what does he say to Moses? Moses is on holy ground. Why was the ground holy there at this great mountain of Horeb? Is that it? Right, because God was there. It was no more than that. That's the only thing. This is a great mountain. A lot of great things happen on this particular mountain, but it was holy only because God was there. And you notice right away when he turned and it's implied he was going to go and check out this bush that wasn't being consumed, that God stopped him right away. Don't come near. Because God's unapproachable. And from a physical standpoint, you can't look upon God and live. I mean, he is so beyond our knowledge, his greatness and, again, his holiness, that we should recognize that. That's why we often talk about, and this is, you know, we won't elaborate on that, but let me just ask you this. Is God in our presence right now? Yes. So if that was holy ground where Moses was, for no other reason than God was there, aren't we on holy ground right now? You stop and think about it. Aren't we in the presence of God? This is holy ground. It has nothing to do with the building being sacred or anything like that. But we're in the presence of God. And we can very easily forget that. Because we come every Wednesday, we're here, and we do the same things. We study, and then, you know, we sing, and on Sunday we do the same, and we do it over and over. And that's a wonderful thing. It's a great opportunity and a blessing that we can worship God so regularly, and we can do it without any outside interference. But the danger in it is that it can become normal to us. It can be something that's not special to us. If we're not careful. And now, you know, a lot of people, that's why they don't observe the Lord's Supper every week. It's because they think, well, if you do it every week, it's going to become an ordinary event, nothing special about it. And so we just do it a couple of times a year, make it a real big deal. Is that the right approach towards worship? No, we do what God instructs us to do. And while there is a danger for you to every time when we partake of the Lord's Supper, for you to just kind of go through the motions, there is a danger, but that's a problem we all have to deal with ourselves. We have to make sure in our own minds that that doesn't happen. And that's true not just with the Lord's Supper, but with everything. Every time we come together, we're in the presence of God. And so what we are doing is special. We are, from that standpoint, we are on holy ground right now, tonight, because we're in the presence of God. Question is, do we act like it? So, yeah.
From a different perspective, I suppose, we are always in God's presence.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
There's never a time that God doesn't know exactly what we're doing, who we are, what we're all about.
Right, and right. It's a good point.
At times, probably, we don't think, I'm sure at times we don't think about that, but we are never out of the sight of God.
Right.
You know, we just aren't.
Right.
He's always there, always present.
Yes, yes. And so from that standpoint, when you look at it from that standpoint, it's very important that you always, every day of your life, whatever you're doing, you recognize God and who he is, the power that he possesses, and that he is holy. And that shapes everything. It does shape our outward behavior, that we have that right perspective with regard to holiness and God's holiness particularly. Now, we remember what Peter says, of course, that God is holy. So what did he say about holiness to Peter? Do you recall 1 Peter 1, about verse 16 or so in that area? God's holy. So what did he say he wants us to be? Wants us to be holy. Be ye holy, for I am holy. And so when we think about what Dale said, and we're always in the presence of God, and so it's not like, okay, we're going to act holy here on Wednesday night because we're all here, the Bible study, we're in building and everything, and so we're going to be holy tonight for the next hour or whatever. Or every Lord's Day, we'll be holy, yeah, but it doesn't really matter what I do during the rest of the week, but on Sunday, we're going to be holy, we're going to do holy things, and we're going to partake of the Lord's Supper, and that's wonderful. And then you can kind of click that off Monday because no longer the Lord's Day. It's not the way it works, is it? Now, that's the way a lot of people live, but we have to make sure we don't live like that. That God is holy and we're always in his presence and we need to respect the fact that he knows exactly what we're doing. And so, now, there's a positive, as we get down into this, there's a positive side of that. And again, always being in the presence of God. Notice, as he continues here then, we talked last week, I think, I am the God of your father, and the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Now, I think we closed here last week talking about this. That I am the God of your father and the God of Abraham and so on. That reminds us of the fact of what Jesus did, or what happened with Jesus with the Sadducees when they confronted him and were trying to tempt him. And they came up with that wild scenario, remember, of a man who's married, a woman who's married, her husband dies, and then he has seven other brothers, or you know, whatever, and all of that. They all die, and so she becomes a widow seven times over. And so whose wife is she going to be in the resurrection? And you know, just really a bizarre situation. The Pharisees, the Sadducees, rather, just trying to trap him in a silly kind of way. He didn't even bother to answer them. He just exposed their shallow knowledge. And what did he say in response? You remember? Instead of giving them really an answer to that, what did he say?
He's the God of the living.
Yeah, he went on to say that he is the God of the living. That gets to our text. But the first thing he said, in heaven there's not going to be what? Not going to be any marriage. Like, why are you asking me this silly question? There won't be any marriage in heaven. So it just really exposed their shallow knowledge. But then he goes on, because he knew who they were. The Sadducees were the ones who rejected the life after death and that sort of thing, the resurrection and all of that. And so he just takes the time to quote our very passage in Exodus chapter 3, when God said, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And he emphasizes the part of that, that I am, not I was, but I am. And then he says what Dale said, that we know God is the God of the living, not the God of the dead. So our passage in Exodus chapter 3 proves, that Jesus uses it to prove there is life after death. You don't cease to exist when you die. And so we understand that. And there's something else. I think in Luke's account of this, we'll not go over there and read it now. One of the things that always comes up when you're studying any of these first five books of the Bible, who's the author of the Pentateuch? And traditionally, we have said that it's Moses, and there's a lot of evidence for that. And, you know, later liberal scholars have come along and denied that, and Bible critics even say, oh, that's impossible, it proves you Christians don't know what you're talking about. But in Luke's account of this, of what we were talking about in Matthew with the Sadducees trying to tempt Jesus, in Luke's account of it, he actually refers to the bush as it's said in Luke, the story that took place at the bush. But he says, Moses showed and went on to talk about the resurrection. But when he says Moses showed, what does that prove? That what? Right, right.
Now,
I'm sorry? Oh, he does. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, that proves without question, because this comes from Jesus. It's one thing if a bunch of scholars came together and they have, and we have, and we have studied, and we've looked at different ways of proving that Moses is the author of the Pentateuch. But when Jesus says it, that settles it, doesn't it? Like, Jesus believed that Moses wrote the book of Exodus. And so if Jesus believed it, I think I might believe that too. And so we know that's a good way of proving that, just kind of as a side note with regard to that. All right, let's move on from that then. Verse 7, it says, and then the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and I have heard their cry because of the taskmasters. I know their suffering. And so once again, it seems as if that would imply that the persecution against God's people has been intensified for whatever reason, and now they get to the point finally where they're crying out to God and he hears them. And the wording of this is very comforting to all of us. I have surely seen the affliction of my people. We know this is dealing with a specific thing, but is that still true today? Does God, when you're suffering, does God know about it? Absolutely. That's true about his people as a whole. It's true about local congregations. It's true about individual Christians. God sees the affliction of his people. And that should really comfort us. We're never all alone when we're going through difficult times in life. God knows that what we're going through. And notice what it says. I've seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt and have heard their cry because of the taskmasters. At verse 8 he says, and I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians. It's not like God just saw their affliction and knew that they were suffering. He was now responding to it. And it's not like he was absent for these 400 years when they were being afflicted. But again, you remember, as I've pointed out in our study, that God's on a timetable here. He's doing things according to his own timetable, because there's a lot of factors, a lot of things happening. The Israelites had to be ready for deliverance, and the Canaanites and all the people in the promised land, their sins had to become full before he would drive them out. So all of that is in play and going on. But when they finally, they're being afflicted and they cried out, God heard, but he didn't just hear. He says, I have come down now. He knew they were afflicted and he does something about it. And when we think about that, first of all, with God, we understand that he was a sympathetic God. He sympathized with his people when he saw their affliction. But then he is showing compassion. He's actually doing something about it. It's one thing to feel bad for somebody, to have sympathy for individuals who are suffering, even brethren when they're going through a hard time. Oh, I hear, brother is doing, the brother is going through this or that, and you feel bad about that. That's sympathy. Compassion is when we act. We might say sympathy is how we feel. Compassion has to do with how we act. And if we're really going to do anybody any good, it begins with sympathy. You have to feel something. But if it just stops with sympathy, it really is kind of useless when you think about it. I don't know, sympathy is not a bad thing, but if all you ever have is sympathy towards those who are suffering, those who are hurting, it's kind of useless. It's the compassion that is very is important. And I remember John. If you turn over to 1 John chapter 3, you probably remember this passage. 1 John chapter 3 and about verse 16. 1 John 3 and verse 16. Right in there. Let's see. Verse 16. 1 John 3, verse 16, it says, by this we know love, that he laid down his life. Talking about Jesus, of course, he laid down his life for us. So Jesus acted, didn't he? And we think of John 3 at verse 16. For God so loved the world that what? He gave. He gave. He had compassion, of course. He had sympathy, rather, of course. But he did something. He knew man was in sin. Man needed to be rescued. But he did something. He loved the world, so he gave. And we see that here with Jesus, even, that Jesus is acting. And this we know love, that he laid down his life for us. And we, now watch this, we ought to lay down our lives for the brothers. But if anyone has the world's goods and see his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him? Little children, let us not love in word or talk. And you understand what that means is word or talk only is really what that means. Like, is there anything wrong with me telling you that I love you as brethren? No, nothing wrong with expressing your love for others, for family members, for husband and wives to express that. And nothing wrong with expressing love, but there is something wrong with expressing love only. With love only being word or talk. That's not really love at all. Love is action. And so John says here, little children, let us not love in word or talk, but in deed and in truth. And that's God. We can learn from God. That's what God did. That's what God did even with the Israelites. He heard their affliction. He heard their cries. He saw their suffering. He sympathized with them because of that. And then he came down to do something about it. He acted. And that's what he's revealing to Moses back here in Exodus chapter 3. So he comes down. He tells them that, referring to him appearing in the burning bush. He has come down. I have come down. And then he says there's a purpose behind all of this, to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites and the Hittites, the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites. And now behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression which the Egyptians, with which the Egyptians oppressed them. Now let me show you something else here, just as a practical point, and that this is a real picture of salvation here and how it works even with us. Notice he says here that he's come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, to bring them up out of the land. That's step one. To bring them up out of the land to a good and broad land. That's step two. And that's salvation. It's a deliverance from something. But it also involves a blessing of something else. And like you think about us and our salvation. First, we're delivered from what? From sin. And ultimately, what? From death, spiritual death, from hell, aren't we? Like, that's your destiny. If you don't obey the gospel of Christ, you're destined to a devil's hell. That's where we're. But as Christians, God has delivered us through His Son Jesus Christ, of course. We've been delivered from that land of bondage. And now He is going to bring us to a new land, heaven. And both of those things should be emphasized in our teaching, in our preaching, and even just in our own minds as we live our life from day to day. Like, it's wonderful that we have been delivered from that land. If that would be great if I didn't know anything else about what God's going to do for us in the future. And I was just left with the option. Okay, here's your situation. You can be delivered from a devil's hell. You can be delivered from the wrath of God and just cease to exist. Or you can be obedient to God and perish in a devil's hell. Which would you choose? A or B? I'd be just fine with B, wouldn't you? Like, that's a blessing all by itself, just to escape the ultimate expression of God's wrath, which is the lake of fire. If that's all we had. I know you're thinking, there's more. Yeah, there's more. We know we have the Bible. We know there's more. But just that first part. Like the first part with Israel was him delivering them from the land of Egypt. That was a wonderful blessing to put a stop to that terrible affliction and bondage that they were going through and that they were experiencing. Delivering from that was something for them to be thankful for the rest of their lives. And so it is with us, with salvation. If all you ever got out of serving God is you escape hell, that's worth it, isn't it? Like, you know, I'm delivered from hell and then I'm going to die and cease to exist. All right, that'd be better than the alternative. You know, the alternative, you can disobey God and spend eternity in hell. No, I think I'll take B. But by the grace of God, we have more. We have the whole picture of salvation. We're delivered not only from a devil's hell, but now he's offering us a home and the beautiful place called heaven. And that's wonderful. And again, we need to emphasize that. Like, I need to preach sermons about hell so that you can really understand the importance of escaping the wrath of God in that place. And sometimes, it's like, again, it's just like we were talking about our services and things that we can sort of treat as normal and take for granted. And we can do that with every part of the Bible and all the teachings of God's Word. Like, you can even get to the point where you're not thankful that you have escaped that destiny of hell. And where in reality, we should be thanking God for that every day. Thank God we're not on that path. How many people in this world are going down that road that leads to destruction? What did Jesus say? That's broad, isn't it? That's the wide way. Most people are on that road. Thank God that you're not. It has very little to do with you. It has everything to do with the love of God, the gospel of Christ, the sacrifice of Jesus. Thank God you have been delivered from that. But then we also need to think about in our own minds and teach lessons and sing songs about heaven. Because that should be more motivation for us to live the way we ought to live. Not only are we going to escape hell, but we have an opportunity to spend one glorious eternal day in heaven. And that's the whole picture. And we see a glimpse of that here, even with the deliverance from a physical standpoint, the deliverance of the Egyptians. He says, I'm going to bring you up out of the land. Again, that's step one. But he's going to take them, give them the good and broad land, the land flowing with milk and honey. Now, he goes on then at verse 10. Now watch this. You can think Moses is probably thrilled at all of this. Remember, Moses wanted the people to be delivered 40 years previously. He kind of jumped the gun. And he thought, as we again look at what Stephen says in Acts chapter 7, we learn from that he really thought somehow, some way, he was going to deliver his brethren. That's why he went out to visit his brethren. And that's what got him into trouble when he saw the Egyptian abusing his brethren and he ended up killing them. But he thought, remember what Stephen said? He thought that they would have understood that he was going to deliver them. But it wasn't time for that. And God hadn't revealed any of that. And so he was really jumping the gun. He didn't wait on God. And so, but what that tells us is that he had developed that kind of love for his brethren. Even though he grew up an Egyptian. He never forgot who he was and where he was from. And so he had that connection with his brethren, with the Hebrews. And he wanted to deliver them. But because he jumped the gun, it had to be pushed off for another 40 years. But now here we are. And finally, God appears to him 40 years later out of the burning bush. And he's telling Moses, I've heard the affliction of my people. And I'm going to deliver them. And because we know Moses and that he loved his brethren, you know that excited him. And that's great, God. I want to be right with you. Get that job done. But then you read verse 10. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. That kind of changed things for Moses. Like, wait a minute. I thought you were going to do that. I'm glad to hear about it, but when he says, no, come, I'm going to send you. Now we see from the rest of this passage and then into chapter 4, Moses begins to hesitate and draws back a little bit, like, no, I can't do that. And he should have known. When God appeared to him in the burning bush, he should have known. He was appearing to him for a reason. Like he was going to give him a duty. He was going to have him do something. He didn't appear in the burning bush just for Moses' entertainment, just to break up his monotonous life as a shepherd. He was appearing to do something. And Moses was going to have a part in it. And that's when Moses begins to hesitate. What about us? We think of the revelation. Why does God reveal himself to us through his word? He reveals his word to us. Is it just to satisfy some curiosity that we have? Is it just for our entertainment? No. Whenever you think about revelation, you know, I have a little sermon I preach sometimes. Why was the Bible written? And there's a lot of things that I put in there for it was written for this reason, that reason. But one reason it was written is to cause us to do. Not just to feel better. Not just to feel good. And the Bible does all of that. It makes us feel good. But at the end of the day, the Bible was given to us to move us to action, to do the will of God. And now Moses, it is time. God has appeared to him. He has told him the good news. I've heard the affliction of the people you wanted to deliver. It is about to happen. 40 years have passed, and now I'm going to deliver them. But I'm sending you. You're the one that's going to go before Pharaoh. And he starts making excuses. You ever make excuses for not doing what God wants you to do? Anybody ever been guilty of that here? You think anybody in the body of Christ has ever made an excuse for not doing God's will? Some of the same excuses Moses makes, we sometimes make. And there is no real excuse for not doing the will of God. He has revealed his will to us for a purpose. It's our job to learn it and do it. And so Moses is going to find that out. So, verse 11, Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt?" He said, "But I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain." And then Moses said to God, "If I come to the people of Israel and say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you,' and they ask me, 'What is his name?' what shall I say to them?" And so in all of this, we see that Moses basically, as he is kind of trying to get out of this thing, he basically is looking at two things. Who am I? And who are you? Is basically what he is saying. And so he's going to get the answer. And so, yeah, Dale.
We all know about Moses and the excuses that he made and all that. And I thought, in comparison, look at how what his feelings were about all this. And then you look at Saul of Tarsus on the road to Damascus, and the Lord appeared unto him. There were no excuses. He just did exactly what the Lord had told him to do.
Right.
So, which way do we want it? Which way are we really?
Right.
When you stop and think about it.
Right.
Saul didn't have any excuses. He didn't offer any excuses. He just went, did exactly what the Lord had told him to do.
Right. Yeah. And that's good you bring that up, because the Bible's filled of those kind of things, comparisons. That we have how different Bible personalities act and what they do with the Word of God when they receive it. And there's a lot of contrast. And we're often faced with the question, who are we going to follow? Who are we going to be like? And listen, overall, it's like we have said with all these individuals. With Abraham, we saw he had a lot of faults and everything. No doubt. But listen, I hope that I can be anywhere close to Abraham in the faith that he had. And it's like Moses, you know, he didn't get everything right all the time. It's why it's great to study these individuals, because they were humans just like us. And here is a side of Moses that probably we could all relate to. Like, this was not a small thing. When God all of a sudden said, "Okay, Moses, I'm sending you to Pharaoh." Who is Pharaoh? Probably the most powerful man on earth. And now he's going to have to go back to where he fled from all that time ago. And when he was fleeing last time, don't forget, the people basically rejected him. Kind of summarized it by the words of the one brother, "Who are you? Who made you a judge over us?" And now he has to go back and not only deal with Pharaoh and stand before him, but somehow convince his brethren that he's the leader that they need to deliver them from Egypt. And so, who am I to do that? And who are you? Because they're going to ask me, who's sending me? And I'm going to have an answer. So we'll look at that next week. Those two things with regard to Moses. Who am I and who are you? And so we'll look at that. Appreciate your attention.